Hello, everybody, and welcome to an extended free preview of this month's episode of What a Cartoon Movie All About Atlantis, The Lost Empire. I am one of your hosts, the sporty tuna writer, Bob Mackey, and who is here with me today, as always?
Carefully sifting through his dirt, Henry Gilbert.
And yes, this month we are looking at Atlantis, The Lost Empire, the 2001 Disney movie that severely underperformed. And it's because we're looking at all of these weird Disney movies of the early aughts throughout the summer of 2025. And yes, Atlantis is a fascinating subject. It's the directors of both Beauty and the Beast and The Hunchback of Notre Dame saying, what do people want from Disney in the future? They want adventure movies with a harder edge. It turns out they were not accurate in their estimation of the American audience. But they still made a moderately interesting movie with a lot of flaws, and we had a lot of fun looking at it.
Yeah, it was a very interesting history of the making of Atlantis, and from the directors of two of my favorite Disney Renaissance films, and then we end up with something that is like not a musical and is like a classic Indiana Jones style adventure. And yeah, it has its ups and downs. Atlantis is a snore, but getting there is more fun than actually arriving.
Mm-hmm. Atlantis is kind of boring, but if you want to hear the fascinating history of the making of this movie, you're going to hear a little bit of it in this preview, but if you want to hear the rest of it and also get an entire podcast about the movie, which I'm guessing will be 5 or 6 hours long, go to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons and sign up at the $10 level. And when you do, you'll get to access the rest of the history of Atlantis, The Lost Empire, and also get an entire discussion of the movie. In total, this podcast is likely around 5 or 6 hours, and then you'll have access to the vast back catalog of What a Cartoon Movie episodes, nearly 7 years of those to date. We've covered every Disney movie of the 90s that was released in theaters. We've covered all the Toy Story movies. We've covered weird movies like both Beavis and Butthead movies and the Rocko's Modern Life movie. We've covered anime like Ghost in the Shell and Akira and Kiki's Delivery Service and Whisper of the Heart. If there's an animated movie out there that you want us to cover, we probably have, and if not, we'll likely cover it in the future, and it's all happening at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons at the $10 level. And that 10 bucks also gets you into our $5 stuff. Henry, what's going on there?
Well, if you enjoy ad-free podcasts, then you need to sign up there because you'll get to hear all the What a Cartoon podcasts without ads. Like you'll hear next week's about Superman with no ads in it, but that's just the tip of the iceberg because we also do tons of bonuses there that you can only hear if you're a $5 or $10 a month subscriber. Each month, we do a new episode of Talking Futurama and Talk King of the Hill, where we go into Futurama and King of the Hill as in-depth as we do a film like Atlantis, The Lost Empire. We're now into the second year of the Comedy Central run of Futurama, and we're in the middle of season 4 of King of the Hill. And when you sign up, you get the entire back catalog of over 200 exclusive bonus miniseries episodes there, too. Us covering every episode of The Critic, every episode of Mission Hill, many of our favorite episodes of Batman, the animated series.
And if you've never been part of Patreon before, it's so easy to sign up. And when you do, you can access all of our bonus podcasts the same way you access all of your regular podcasts as part of your podcasting lifestyle. And if you want to use the Patreon app for any smart device you might have, you can do that as well. But no matter which way you do it, it is so easy to access everything waiting for you behind the Patreon paywall at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. But that is it for our little intro. Now grab a bowl of beans, bacon, whiskey, or lard, your choice, and get ready to hear a portion of our history of Atlantis, the Lost Empire. So we have been talking a lot about the state of Disney and the aughts extensively over the last 2 months. We don't need to go into too much detail about where the company was at this point in time, but in case you need a refresher, we're going to provide one up front. So after the highs of the 1990s, Tarzan, that's when Disney goes out in a blaze of glory. They were humbled a bit by a few features that underperformed, like The Emperor's New Groove, Fantasia 2000, and Fantasia 2000 basically bombed. That was a significant bomb for Disney and a very like a passion slash vanity project. But they had a few low-key hits like the Tigger movie, which was animated primarily in Japan, and Dinosaur, which we all forget had zero cultural impact. Nobody wants to look at it ever again. It was the fifth highest grossing movie of the year 2000. That's how big it was.
That is insane. I my brain never wants to remember this information every time I hear it about Dinosaur, because it's so forgettable. The most, I've never watched the film, but I have ridden the ride in Orlando, and I only wrote it because it's about to close. That's why I wrote it.
I only know about Aladar because they bring it up on Podcast The Ride as a joke. But I remember in the Hunchback of Notre Dame podcast, I was getting cranky because people assumed that movie was a flop, and really it was like a big, big hit for the 90s. I'm the jerk who assumes Dinosaur is a flop. Oh, nobody liked it. Nobody remembers it. No, only four movies did better than it that calendar year. People went crazy for that hideous dinosaur movie.
Because it tricked us all. Like, I remember that first trailer for it. That's like the opening of the movie. I thought everything around it was CGI, but it was real. It was mostly, I believe, real backgrounds or real settings. And then they animated the dinosaurs into it, I think.
Yeah. But they basically shot live-action plates and then put CGI dinosaurs over them to fool everybody.
Yeah, you know, I just watched there's a pretty good Industrial Light and Magic documentary series on Disney Plus that is kind of truthful. Jurassic Park gets an entire episode because it's basically is like, oh yeah, this changed everything, and not for the better in some ways. Like, they have Phil Tippett on there is just like, oh, once they were able to build that T-Rex, I knew my job was over, and they like fucked it. Like, I was never going to get to animate monsters anymore in any movie.
Yeah, I think they even put one of the quotes that Phil Tippett said in the movie in Jeff Goldblum's character, like, I guess we're the ones who are going extinct or something like that.
Yes, yeah, that's I'd heard that story many times in this documentary. When Phil Tippett says it, he tells the story of like that Steven Spielberg had hired him to be like, you're the guy who's in charge of animating all the dinosaurs, and then he's in the meeting where they see the CGI T-Rex, and he's like, so, Phil, I think we're going to go the other. And then Phil Tippett is trying to not, like, have an entire, like, disassociative meltdown because his career is over in his mind. And he says, like, you know, I feel extinct. And then he says that Steven Spielberg goes, oh, my God, I'm putting that in the movie. That's great.
It is a great line about that's the end of me.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, speaking of CGI, in terms of what other studios are doing at this point in time, we talked about this, we've covered these films, but Pixar is getting a huge amount of buzz. All the focus is on Pixar. They're still independent. Disney is distributing their films, of course. So to date, they have made two Toy Stories and A Bug's Life, and Monsters, Inc. will be, I think, that fall, the fall of 2001, I'm pretty sure.
Yes, yeah, that's the, and that, like, does so good, and it's the one that wins the Oscar over Shrek in the first animated feature Oscar.
Yes, and I'm glad you brought up Shrek, because DreamWorks had just left a big ogre-shaped crater in the world of animated cinema with Shrek, which changed everything. So Atlantis is really the first post-Shrek animated feature, coming just maybe 2 months later, and Shrek proved people don't want Broadway musicals. People don't want epic adventures in their animated movies back then. What they wanted was warmed over sitcom jokes and celebrity voices. And that was the case for a very long time.
And characters who go like, can you believe this princess bullshit? Like, I bet this guy's gay. Like, they like jokes like that now.
Yes, lots of gay jokes, lots of gay panic, lots of dick jokes. Atlantis was, it was not their fault, but they thought, okay, maybe people are ready for this. It turns out it was a real curveball in the terms of what people wanted from animated movies.
Yeah, the Disney 2D is in a weird place that will eventually, like, it's a cul-de-sac. We mentioned the one after this, Lilo and Stitch, is like them trying to make a smaller thing, but I guess CGI is still like encroaching in ever more in each new Disney 2D movie at this time too.
Yeah, there's a ton in this compared to whatever was in Emperor's New Groove and whatever was in Tarzan. I mean, Tarzan used a lot of digital like techniques in terms of the deep canvas stuff, but not a lot of 3D objects, CGI objects that were that apparent. Here, you're seeing so many ships, so many CGI like soldiers. It's very obvious.
It helps that the architectural style, or the like, the style of all of the mechanics or vehicles in this, I think they work well for what the limits of CGI were then. But it makes every vehicle CGI in this. It a couple times I was disassociating a little from the movie of just like oh, like here's somebody touching polygons here.
Yeah, and honestly, some of the CGI looks like it wouldn't be out of place on a Futurama episode of that era. I was surprised by how kind of cheap it looked at times. We'll talk about it when we talk about the movie though. So the story of Atlantis begins in the year 1996, late 96. So after the promotional campaign for The Hunchback of Notre Dame is over, Producer Don Hahn summons Gary Trousdale and Kirk Wise to what they call a very crappy Mexican restaurant in Burbank that's no longer open. And writer Tab Murphy is invited to the party as well. He wrote The Hunchback of Notre Dame. And Hahn is meeting with them because he wants to keep the Hunchback team together for another feature. And in order to do this, they need to come up with a pitch as soon as possible. So basically, if this team just sat around after the project, Disney would assign them something. So they were in no position to be told what to do anymore. Trousdale and Wise made Beauty and the Beast. They made Hunchback. They were in the position to say, this is the next movie we're making. And Don Hahn said, you need to take advantage of this moment in your career.
Yeah, and a thing that came up so many times, I hear that like in Lilo and Stitch, when they say that Chris Sanders was like got it in his deal that he gets to pitch a project of his own, and that's what Lilo and Stitch became. I think the unspoken thing in those stories is, and probably in this one too, is if we don't give these guys something, Jeffrey Katzenberg is going to hire them away to DreamWorks with a better deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there was not a lot of time to sit around on your hands at Disney because they wanted to keep you very busy. So Trousdale notes that many pitchers of margaritas were consumed, and the team decided on a few things. One, they were really sick of the Disney House style, what made the Renaissance big, which was the big Broadway-style epics. So as a change of pace, they wanted to make a big, bold adventure film in the style of classic live-action Disney films like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and The Island at the Top of the World. All these things I would see on TV that would bore me to tears as a young millennial child. These are the touchstones these like late Gen X, early boomers were really fascinated by.
Yeah. Whenever I'd see those ones, like I gave a real college try to watching 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, the Disney version in my youth. Maybe I was spurred on by the funny Kelsey Grammer Saturday Night Live sketch about it. Like, old Mr. Old 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
And that leagues was not a measure of depth. It was a measure of distance. That was the big point of contention in that sketch.
I think so. I think that was it. Yeah. But I think those movies, like, they got ruined by me growing up watching, like, Star Wars and Indiana Jones movies, because those also took inspiration from the serials and like the old action films, except they were like, no, we're giving you like 30 times the action that you got in those movies.
Yeah. And even things like Indiana Jones.
Definitely Indiana Jones for sure. Yeah.
So in Kirk Wise's words, they had made their Fantasyland movie and now they wanted to make an Adventureland movie. They had t-shirts made for the production team. And the quote on the shirt was, fewer songs, more explosions. This is the direction they wanted to go. So it wasn't necessarily audience getting sick of songs. It was the people making these movies who were like, we're done with the Broadway thing. Can we just make something else?
Yeah, Hunchback was a very good musical, but I can see after they've like timed out their 30th musical, like I feel like the internal plan is write this to know that it's going to be like literally a Broadway musical eventually. That probably also makes you feel kind of boxed in creatively, knowing the adaptation is coming at this point.
So they have these very broad guidelines in mind. Then they start discussing the specifics of this new project. So they wanted it to be a period piece set around the turn of the 20th century, and it wouldn't just be a simple adventure story. They wanted it to be, quote unquote, a guys on a mission story or a team movie, sort of like The Great Escape in that fashion of movie where there's like a bunch of people on a team. They all have these bold personalities. They all have different skills and they work together to solve a problem, go on an expedition, et cetera, et cetera. It's a classic formula.
Oh, yeah. I forget what podcast it was we talked about, like how Brad Bird and all of these other guys, like they grew up Gen X and boomer animators, they love the Great Escape film. Like they reference it so much in all of their like animation and movies. It comes up so much like these, like a team comes together to solve a problem type stories.
I love that movie. And I need to watch it again. I only watched it once, like maybe 20 years ago, but the title should be The Great Escape ... and The Eventual Murder. Because they do escape, but then they're all killed because they have to follow the actual story of the men who did this.
Yeah, it's maybe they expected people knew that's where it was going. Back then when it first came out, they're like, people know the story, right?
I guess it's not a spoiler because it happened to these men, but I was surprised by that. I was like, oh, what a downer. I thought they escaped, and it's like, hooray, we made it. The end. No. It was the end, but not in a movie sense. So they even considered Kirk and Trousdale considered adapting Journey to the Center of the Earth, the classic novel. But according to Trousdale, the book doesn't really go anywhere. And I guess in the novel, they get to the center of the earth and then they run away. And then the last third of the book is in complete darkness. So there's not a lot of like ways to adapt that unless you change it drastically.
In general, I have not really read much Jules Verne. I think I read The Time Machine, like actually did, or as a kid. But other than that, not so much the other ones. I did see in the Netflix seasons, they did a Journey to the Center of the Earth on Mystery Science Theater. So that's the most I have gotten in contact with the adaptations of it, I think.
Well, I'll tell you, I've ridden the Journey to the Center of the Earth ride at Disney Sea. They also have a 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea ride. A lot of Disney Sea, this theme park made for cool Japanese teenagers, is based in Victorian era sci-fi.
I totally forgot that Jules Verne section of it. Yes. Okay. So you're right. I've also experienced the ride. So I assume during the book, you run into a giant, like, underground space alien type guy, and then you're rushed outside very quickly.
Yes. So maybe I'd rather ride the ride than read the book. Except there's a huge drop. They don't tell you about that huge drop, and it scared the shit out of me. I don't like drops.
It's a big drop. It's probably the biggest. I think, no, it's not the most intense ride at Disney Sea. It's the Indiana Jones minecart style ride in there is the most. I've only ridden it once. That one was too intense for me, too.
Which one was that? Is that the actual Indiana Jones ride?
No, it's right next to Indiana Jones. Like, I don't think it is branded Indiana Jones, but it is like mine carts, and you're supposed
to. It's a roller coaster, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I almost rode that, but then I chickened out. Maybe next time. So, yes, there's a lot of ideas floating around for this potential movie, but here is what the team didn't know. So, during his very brief period at Disney in the 90s, Joss Whedon was working on an Atlantis project for Disney that he described as Journey to the Center of the Earth meets The Man Who Would Be King. And weirdly enough, while at the studio, he apparently completed a draft of a Marco Polo musical that they never made. So they were trying to make Joss Whedon happen at Disney in the early 90s. So despite his story by credit, Joss Whedon has absolutely nothing to do with this movie, to the point where Trousdale and Wise were surprised to see his name in the credits when they first watched it, a rough cut of the credits for the first time. And it turns out Disney just didn't want to go into court about this. They didn't want to litigate. So they just gave him a story by credit to say, okay, you worked on some other version of this that has nothing to do with what these two guys came up with independently.
Now Joss Whedon is avoiding litigation in different ways these days. But yeah, no, I think that's crazy. Like, this would have been around the same time he was working on Toy Story, right?
Yeah, and maybe some listeners can let me know if there's anything else, but I'm pretty sure all that ever came out of this Disney period was Whedon really improving Toy Story. I mean, despite what a weird creep he was, he did do a lot of things to make Toy Story into the movie it became. So, but I think that's pretty much it in terms of his work at Disney that went public, that became something we can watch.
Well, it is interesting to hear there's, you know, little actual connective tissue of his version to this, because like this nerdy guy surrounded by a crew of cool dudes and going on an adventure like, and also like a relatively nativist, like, or a magic supergirl who kicks ass. Like, these are mm-hmm. Whedon-y tropes. Like, this is all over the Firefly TV series, or also the
Buffy.
Yeah, Buffy. Or I was going to say his Alien movie too, like the he wrote Alien Resurrection.
Oh, okay. I didn't see that, but yeah, I mean, Buffy and the other things are all happening around this time. This is like the rise of Whedon is happening in the early aughts.
Did you recently watch The City of Lost Children, or am I thinking of a different
person? Yes, I did. Okay. Yes, I did.
Because it's the same director as that than did that movie.
Alien Resurrection. Like total like music video vibes. The movie's not great, but it's just like fun to gawk at that film.
You could just go on vibes back then. Like,
it's, yeah, we don't have vibes now. I don't care. A lot of these movies, you would see reviews like, "Oh, it's all style, no substance." I just want style again. We can't do that anymore.
It's funny, too. You would think that Ron Perlman is in this movie as well, just how it feels like there. But I'm just thinking because it's a Mignola style thing. Why isn't Hellboy in this?
He should be. He should be creeping around the corners here. So getting the green light for this project was very easy, thanks to all of the high-level political drama happening at Disney in the late 90s. So Michael Eisner, who was a big supporter of Trousdale and Wise, was feuding with Roy Disney. And the president of Walt Disney Feature Animation and the Disney Studios president were both way more focused on their theatrical division, getting that off the ground. So not a lot of eyes were on this project. A lot of bigwigs were very distracted, especially Roy Disney and Eisner. So they had a lot more freedom and not as much high-level executive oversight as they were used to. And obviously Katzenberg is gone at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I get the when you mentioned the theatrical thing, it does. I remember that from Disney War, that it's like from the audiobook of Disney War that it definitely seemed, obviously, for these animation presidents, they want to go to Broadway and be and live in New York and work on a Broadway musical. Like, that is more exciting than watching animators, you know, pitch story reels and animatics, yeah, and all that.
Especially that Thomas Schumacher guy was a big, or maybe even still is a big, Disney theatrical bigwig.
I believe he came from a theater background, yeah, and so, like, for him it was getting back to his roots, yeah.
So Eisner also really trusted the material because he is the guy who greenlit Raiders of the Lost Ark for Paramount. So and he worked with George Lucas to bring the Indiana Jones ride to Disneyland. So he's like, people love this big adventure stuff. It's like, it sells itself. Go do whatever you need to do. This is going to be a surefire hit. So with Atlantis, Trousdale and Wise were looking to break from the expected Disney formula, and they also wanted the film to look different as well. So this is when they reached out to a guy we mentioned earlier in the podcast, writer and artist Mike Mignola. Now, his name is very tricky, and I was saying it weirdly until I listened to the Hellboy commentary 20 years ago when Guillermo del Toro, another name I can barely say, says his name a lot, and it's just like filet mignon. It's Mike Mignola. So you don't say the, what is the letter you don't say in that? The G?
I guess so,
yes,
yeah.
You don't say the G.
Well, I was starting to read his Hellboy books a whole lot when this movie came out. Like, because I was 2 years after this, I believe it's 03 when the Hellboy film comes out, and I was extremely excited. Parts of this definitely feel like a G, though this is not G rated, but like a lighter version of a Hellboy steampunk team of the BPRD, as they're known in his universe.
Yeah, I wish he was given like full creative control. It would have been great, but they reached out to him. Hellboy was, for the public audience, a going concern since like 94. So people were beginning to know about Hellboy. I think around this time, I was probably reading the comics because friends of mine would lend them to me. The trade paperbacks, they're very cool. And yeah, they would eventually make a Hellboy movie, but this is just him getting his feet wet in the world of filmmaking. And for some reason, I keep forgetting this, they keep making Hellboy movies. And I thought, oh, okay, there was a 2019 one. No, but there was also a 2024 Hellboy movie. And then there's like a bunch of animated Hellboy movies, and the comic is still going. So there's so much Hellboy out there if you want to dive in. It's good.
I'm embarrassed to say I didn't watch the David Harbour one, even though I think like Ian McShane is in it. And I've watched a lot of worse things that Ian McShane is in. But then the most recent one I had heard about, everybody, like all the reviews were saying it looks so cheap. And I was like, I just can't, yeah, bring myself to watch a cheap looking Hellboy.
Well, I believe We Hate Movies did an episode about the 2019 one, and it sounds really bad. So I would avoid it.
Okay. Well, you know what? I don't watch every Ian McShane thing. I didn't watch the Hercules movie starring Dwayne The Rock Johnson that Ian McShane was in, so I don't watch them all.
I'm not watching that either. So Mignola, he worked on character designs, background designs, and even story beats. And in the oral history, Wise points out that the entire ending evolved out of Mignola leaving a drawing on Wise's desk of a stone fish shooting lightning out of its mouth. And there was a little note attached saying, I have an idea, call me. And that just little sketch then evolved into the ending where they're all riding like the fishmobiles.
Oh, that's so cool. Wow. That's yeah. I wondered how involved he was, or if it was just the character design and world design, like just art director style stuff.
Yeah. And apparently Kirk and Trousdale were inspired by the Hercules team because they brought in that guy, Gerald Scarf, as an outsider artist to define the look of the film. Here, though, I don't think it's as effective because Mignola is not the art director. So it's a lot of compromises between Mignola's very distinct style and then the Disney house style. So some characters come off looking very Mignola-y. Some, like Cookie, look like they've just wandered out of like Beauty and the Beast or something. So I feel like there's not as much control as I would want over the characters. And if you look at how Mignola designed the characters, and he's done original illustrations with Milo and other characters, I'm like, that's the movie I want to see. You should have made it look like the pages of Hellboy with all of this like negative space defining characters. But, you know, they can only make something so edgy. They can only make something so different from the Disney formula.
It still needs to be a happy meal at the end of the day.
And yes.
No, you're right on Cookie. Cookie especially, he looks to me like a guy from The Fox and the Hound. Like, he looks like the guy who owns the hound in Fox and the Hound.
Yeah, I see nothing Mignola-y about his design at all. Just like, boy, you should have sent Cookie back to the drawing board. Although any Jim Varney performance is great because we don't get those anymore. And then the team brought in another outsider, Mark Okrand, who developed the Klingon language, starting with Star Trek III, The Wrath of Spock. Or sorry, The Wrath of Spock, well, The Search for Spock. He was pretty pissed about dying, though.
Well, I mean, he does. He wakes up and he's pretty angry, and I believe he needs to have sex before he finishes growing up. You watched three more than recently than me.
Yes, he was like, he had to like grow up on a planet, and like an older woman is seducing him as a teenager. It's very strange.
Yes, it's you know, they have to speed up Spock's rebirth in that movie. That movie bugs me in a lot of ways, in that it undoes everything from the second movie. Like every new event that happened for characters by the end of the second movie is almost all of it is undone by the end of the third movie.
And I don't care about Kirk's stupid son.
Well, hey, then you should be happy that Christopher Lloyd gives him one in that movie.
He deserved it, I say, that Nepo baby. So this guy, he developed the Klingon language for Star Trek. There's a great featurette on the Search for Spock Blu-ray that we got out of the library, and he's on it explaining like how he developed the language. He continued working with the Star Trek people to develop it further. And it's funny, like a lot of the development of language came out of him being a weenie, which I would be too, because yeah. He'd be on the set, and he had written the lines in Klingon. And sometimes the actors wouldn't get the lines right, so he would change the language to reflect that. So he's like, I'm not telling Christopher Lloyd he fucked up again. Let's just say that this word means this now, and let's roll on with the next scene. So he wasn't too precious about it, and I appreciate that. But now, of course, you can take Klingon on Duolingo if you want. You can still go to your Klingon language camps, but this is the guy they got to develop the spoken language. And a guy named John Emerson created the Atlantean alphabet that we see in the film. So they're putting in a lot of work to make this seem like a real place with a real language and a real culture.
Wow, that's really cool. They got the Klingon guy. We were just talking about Klingon as a real language and Klingon weddings in that Simpsons episode, The Big Fat Geek Wedding, which is not a good episode. But we questioned if that was accurate Klingon or just them imitating it. But that guy, I don't think that guy was credited in that episode. They definitely don't mention him on the commentary.
No, maybe the Klingon language is public domain and you can use it if it's just in a Klingon dictionary. I'm not sure. They didn't mention that on the commentary. So I wonder if that was just Hank Azaria improvising Klingon. It kind of sounded like it.
I love that line in Star Trek VI where I think it's the Christopher Plummer Klingon says like, oh, don't you just love hearing Shakespeare in its original Klingon, and the other people at the table like, these fucking guys, like they're so mad. They want to correct him, but this is a diplomatic dinner. I love that bit.
I just saw that again. Great movie. And I guess, I mean, we're talking about Star Trek. They brought in the Klingon language guy. I think Atlantis feels a lot like Star Trek, and it was having a huge moment in the 90s because it's like you have this crew of people on a ship, all of their different skills, all of their different personalities. It is like the team kind of setup. So I really feel like Star Trek did have a big influence on this movie as well.
Oh, yeah. And every member of the crew has their thing to do in it, too. Like, I guess it feels more like TOS in that, like, it's international people. Like in original series, it's like, here's the Japanese guy. Mm-hmm. Here's the Russian. Here's the black woman. The Scottish guy.
And given the ages of Charles Dale and Wise, they were kids when the original Star Trek was airing, so I can see that being a big influence on them. So yeah, more about the Atlantean language. It's meant to be read left to right on the first line, and then right to left on the second line. You go back and forth zigzagging, so it's meant to simulate the flow of water. They thought a lot about this, and there are some actual written languages that flow like that on the page, but they put a lot of work into a movie nobody cares about. Just this language element alone, they really cared about developing this world. I'm just sad we get to it so late in the movie, or at least it feels late to me.
Oh, it feels way late for me, too. Yeah, I think with all that work into it, that makes it even sadder that the lack of success of this, to skip ahead, like that it wasn't big enough to garner a like ride or a land in a Disney theme park. Like, this is the kind of detail that's made to be put into a line display while you're waiting for your Atlantis the Lost Empire ride.
Oh yeah, definitely made to like support an entire animated series, and we'll talk about that soon. So another big change from the classical Disney formula involved the aspect ratio. So Atlantis is in the CinemaScope aspect ratio, 2.35:1 in this case, so very, very wide. And most, if not all, Disney animated features from this era were in the format of 1.85:1. Even more epic things like Tarzan and The Lion King, they were in the aspect ratio you normally associate with like comedies. So there's more stuff on the screen, there's more space on the screen, which means it's a more expensive movie because you have to fill the frame with things. And when you have a tighter screen, there's not as many things that can possibly be moving at once. So already the budget is bigger. And to make things even more complicated, the CAP system, which is the Disney digital animation system we talked about so many times over the years, the default aspect ratio is 1.66 to 1, which is closer to the TV aspect ratio. So sometimes when you dial up a Disney Renaissance movie on Disney Plus, you will see black bars on the sides. That's because the top and bottom information was cropped off when you saw it in a theater. They're showing you all the information that was rendered in that movie. So people are always asking, like, why are there bars on the sides? I thought this was widescreen. Well, it kind of is widescreen.
That's such a gutsy move to make it extra widescreen when they're already, you know, they can, especially in Disney, safely assume that, like, their home media is going to be watched by people in full screen. Like, and it's going to chop off even more. The wider you make it, the more stuff is going to be chopped off on it. Like, that, it's a gutsy move to make something that widescreened.
I think this is not in the oral history, but my own feelings are they probably understood that during the making of the movie that DVD was the next big thing, and they wanted to be ready for that format. And the big appeal of that for a lot of people was, oh, wow, I can finally see all of the movie. So I feel like they were getting ready for that. They were like future-proofing the movie for that.
And I guess people that were getting more HD televisions by then, the conspiracy theory is mentioned on the Simpsons episode that, like, the government was finally stopped dragging their feet on high-definition television.
Thankfully, Charlie didn't have to murder anyone. So when it came to the script written by Tab Murphy, it was one of the biggest the studio had ever encountered for an animated film at that point. In fact, the first two acts of the film in storyboard form ran for 2 hours, and it was at this point the directors realized they needed to start cutting things. So in the oral history, Wise points out that the Disney machine is calibrated to pump out 85-minute movies, and they couldn't push the machinery beyond that. It's what it was designed for. It's what it had the budgets for. It's what it had the staffing for. But in this case, I feel like they were allotted a tiny bit of extra time because the credits begin at 90 minutes, which is a little odd for a Disney 2D feature. Usually are at like 78 or 75 or 72. This one, you were at 90 and then the animation stops.
Yeah, I mean, did they steal minutes from Lilo and Stitch? Because Lilo and Stitch felt like it barely got to 70 minutes when we watched that.
Yeah, this does feel at least like 12 minutes longer than Lilo and Stitch.
Though, man, yeah, I that again is like, that totally makes sense that it was a 2 hour long, like, first two acts, because it really does feel so long before you get to Atlantis in this movie.
Yes, I think one of the biggest problems of this movie is it feels designed to be a 2 hour movie and it can't possibly be that. So it just is just, it feels like a clip show of a 2 hour movie. It just does, the pacing just feels very off to me. But because of the cuts, they had to eliminate a certain few things from the original version of Atlantis. There's only a few things they mentioned, but I noted them down. So Milo was going to have a pet rat named Plato, who was the creator of the Atlantis myth. But then they thought, well, we don't want another cute animal sidekick in a Disney movie. We're done with this crap. So let's cut out Plato. And then there was going to be a nephew character of the Mr. Whitmore, who was the John Mahoney character, this idiot nephew who'd be on the expedition. They're like, we don't need another character. We already have too many. And in general, they pulled back on action sequences and monster attacks because they thought it's more interesting to learn more about these characters. There's a lot of characters and we want to know all their stories. And it's also cheaper to animate dialogue scenes when compared to monster attacks. So let's focus on that instead.
I am surprised to hear about that cute animal sidekick because, yeah, this I now notice this movie doesn't have that, which usually was like a lot of the Katzenberg era ones. It almost feels like sidekicks are given sidekicks in some cases. Like there's Pocahontas, man, there's too many animal sidekicks.
They really doubled up there. But yeah, they didn't need one for this movie. I guess the mole is the closest to a sidekick animal because he's barely a human.
Yes,
and by that I mean he's French. Yeah, I'm kidding.
He's a sickening French gross guy.
Yeah. I'm on the podcast with Henry Gilbert, waving his baguettes around.
The Scottish Gilbert. It's Scots.
I see. I need the 23andMe before we can say this definitively. But ultimately, the directors didn't really mind the shift away from action because they felt it. You know, Atlantis as a place is not interesting. You need to fill this movie with people. And for Atlantis, they also wanted to avoid the typical thing you think of when you see Atlantis, which is like a Greek city. They avoided that entirely. There's no columns. There's no whatever you associate with Greek architecture that is not present in this, because that's what everyone thinks. Atlantis is a Greek city that was swallowed by the ocean, and that's the end of that. No, they wanted to go with something a lot different for their version of Atlantis.
These Atlanteans in this do feel a little more like American indigenous style, maybe, is what I'm feeling from them. Like, so they don't feel like Greeks too much. I suppose they're swarthy in a Greek way, perhaps, but as Greeks can be swarthy.
Yeah, I think they're supposed to be like a little bit Pacific Islander as well.
Yeah, I see that. Yeah.
There's some of that in there, even though one of them is voiced by Leonard Nimoy.
Well, yeah, it is distracting. It's slightly distracting. Like, Leonard Nimoy couldn't be a parent of a Cree summer. It's just they don't sound related.
No. Yeah. Also, why was I weird about talking about Star Trek? Leonard Nimoy's in this movie.
Yes.
When I'm talking about The Search for Spock, I completely forgot Leonard Nimoy plays the King of Atlantis here.
That's true. I guess that's the start of the Star Trek connections in this movie, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. I'll talk more about the production of the movie after I watch the commentary. But everything seemed to be going well with this production. They got a big budget. They had no real oversight. But then three big tragedies happened that really changed this film. And these are what I think really made this a lesser film. And I think it's obvious. This is no real insight for me. But number one, the budget. So at a certain point in the production, the budget got slashed. I can't find a number, but it seems very significant. And they simply didn't have the ability to create the movie that was approved for them. So it seems that Disney might have been getting a little concerned about this very large, unwieldy Atlantis project with this first two acts that were initially 2 hours long. And they were like, all right, we have to cut the budget. Also, we see how animation is changing. The audience might not be here for this 2D movie. That's what I feel was happening internally. And that's why I feel the budget was cut.
Yeah, I mean, after Fantasia was a huge budgetary mess. At least I remember that from Disney War as well. I don't know if we'll ever do Fantasia 2000 because it's kind of a boring movie to discuss as a podcast. But
yeah, when there's so little dialogue, there's only so much we can do with an audio-only medium.
But Fantasia 2000 was like such a, like, it was seen as like Roy E. Disney's big mistake. And like in the shadow of that, they're like, well, I can totally see them tightening budgets on that. And on top of that, their numbers are going down as Pixar movie numbers are going up.
Yeah, they see which way the wind is blowing. And then I have to say that, so this movie, it looks like it cost a bit more than Mulan, but less than Tarzan, so a pretty expensive movie. And there is good animation here, but the film does feel compromised. I believe in the oral history, they're talking about how their budget was slashed and they had to make choices. And a lot of the choices are, okay, which scenes have shadows? That's what they're getting down to. And because of that, you can tell like, oh, a lot of these scenes look very flat because you don't have the shading you are associated with this kind of production, especially when it's being presented to you in CinemaScope. Things look a little flat and a little cheap, even though they spent $100 million making this.
Yeah, now you mentioned that, I do note the bits though where it's like, oh, they're the effects team, not in the CGI sense, but in just like, you know, shadow and light, can only focus on so many things on a tighter budget. Yeah.
So tragedy number one, that was the budget. Tragedy number two was the Columbine Massacre. We cannot talk about 9/11 because it hasn't happened yet. You still have time to celebrate. You should just go see Atlantis because everything's going to change in a few months, everybody. But we can't talk about 9/11. This is another tragedy that changed media in very stupid ways. And if you weren't around for it, you don't know how stupid things got in the 2 year period after Columbine. People were losing their damn minds trying to find a scapegoat. The real actual culprit, of course, is the availability of guns and lack of mental health care and a few other things. But playing Doom, listening to Marilyn Manson, watching anime, that had nothing to do with the Columbine Massacre. And obviously, we all know that.
And two, like, I think you're one of the first people mentioned to me like that. I didn't know this aspect of the Columbine guys were also like a thing they were radicalized on was like white nationalism, too. Like they were racist guys as well. Right.
Yeah. And bullies, too. So like they weren't the picked on nerds, which was the weird narrative a lot of people applied because they wanted to mess with, you know, people they viewed as lesser than them. So that those nerds are dangerous. Let's get them. Let's scapegoat them more.
It was a terrible time to be in high school.
Yeah. Terrible time to be in high school if you're a little weird like me and Henry. So because of Columbine, the gunplay and violence was scaled back drastically, and the team couldn't make this Disney movie with a harder edge like they wanted to. And I read the oral history before watching the movie, and I can definitely tell, like, guns are fired, but there's like a pivotal scene where the colonel has a gun held out to Kida. He's about to shoot her, but like how I'm framed in my Zencaster recording is how the shot is framed. Like, you're not seeing him actually point the gun. You're seeing an extended arm with the gun out of frame. They are so careful about guns in this. And they wanted this to be like an old-fashioned adventure with like guns blazing, but they couldn't do that because of Columbine.
Man, that's geez. Now I'm totally going to notice this. Because the big twist of the movie, your turn, is like all these militaristic guys who came down for this research trip. Turns out those guns are not for show. Like, they're here to point them at people and rob people. Like, these, they're the bad guys. Like, and if you can take away gunplay from that, that's like taking away gunplay from an Indiana Jones movie. It would make it worse.
And I mean, make no mistake, our lovable cast of characters in this movie, they kill so many soldiers at the end of this film. They just kill them, but yeah. It's all off screen. They don't really comment on it. And the entire time, Charles Dale and Wise know we have to make a movie PG or less. We're not going to have like decapitations and blood and extreme violence, but they thought they could do something a little edgier, which is so frustrating to me because that's what they were doing in Hunchback and they're trying to do it here. They're not allowed. And I feel like even to this day, the idea of like a PG-13 Disney film or a Pixar movie would be unthinkable. And it's this, we're like 25 years later, which is why I applaud the work of like Sony and other studios who are willing to make at least an animated movie for teenagers. I feel like maybe by the time I'm on my deathbed, there will be like the animated horror movie, but it's still, they won't allow it to happen. They're so conservative.
Yeah, I just watched K-pop Demon Hunters, which I thought was pretty good. Not like amazing, but I liked it. But it definitely felt like a film made for like teens who have like know what a thirst trap is and and drink alcohol and like these. It was a more fun movie than that. Meanwhile, you read these stories about like how the most recent Pixar films, it was just about Elio as well, or Elio, however it's pronounced, but about how that movie, one of the behind the scenes things was talking about how like apparently Pixar was like preemptively censoring themselves, not being censored or told like, well, tone down this stuff or these adult themes or whatever that by Disney bosses, but instead going like, I bet we'll be told to tone it down. So let's just tone it down before we're even asked.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's Disney's fault for creating a culture where you realize what they're going to attack, but it is their fault for just going ahead and pulling their punches ahead of time. You know, it's very disappointing because we talked about it on the Incredibles podcast. That to me felt like, wow, this is like an adult animated movie, or it's getting closer. Pixar is going to make not like a violent porno, but something that is aging with the audience.
And instead they step back from it every time out of like fear of the same people who will complain about everything will complain about it. Like, and it's either you're scared of them or you're not. But, you know, funny too, the Columbine thing, we talked a ton about that in the Batman Beyond Return of the Joker movie. They planned on making a near R or a hard PG-13 Batman movie, direct to video. And then after Columbine happens, they're told, like, you got to tone this down big time. Remake like 20% of the movie almost.
Yeah, I mean, the changes to media after 9/11 were longer lasting and more drastic, but there was a very stupid 2-year period after Columbine where things nearly got that bad. But we forgot about it because 9/11 was the next tragedy that erased all of those memories.
And it made violence okay again, but in a different way.
Yes, as long as against brown people, you can fire as many guns as you want in those post 9/11 movies.
And torture is important, and it's good. Mm-hmm. Like in torture TV shows will be the biggest TV shows on TV for a time.
Absolutely. So yes, they knew what they had to make, but then Columbine shifted the window as to what was acceptable. So they had to make a more conservative movie in terms of violence. And there are elements in the movie that indicate the kind of tone they wanted, like the character of Wilhelmina, the radio operator who's always smoking. That feels like a marker of a kind of a more edgy movie, because it's like you're not going to see smoking in a Disney film, at least not as something that leads to a gag. This is a character who's just like constantly chain smoking. So I feel like that is one element of kind of what they wanted the film to be like. Oh, like rough around the edges, these gruff characters. There might have been like maybe a little bit of drinking. There was drinking in Beauty and the Beast. There's so much beer in that film.
God, yeah, you're right, man. And the smoking in this one, you're right that this has like basically a night court bailiff amount of smoking here.
Really does. So, and also one of the other tragedies that I've listed to so far, Vikings. So the film had to lose its original opening, which was fully animated in color, cost $5 million. It's on Disney Plus as one of the very few extras. So if you want to see it, it's there. And you'll realize, like, why did this short scene cost $5 million? Well, it's on the goddamn ocean. And there are a lot of, it's just 2D water, 3D effects, very, very, very expensive. So in the opening, we see the Vikings using the same manuscript Milo uses later to find Atlantis. But then the team gradually realize they were setting up a story about finding Atlantis and then finding a book and then finding Atlantis once again. And then it just took way too long to get to Atlantis. So instead, we have a much more efficient opening that actually shows us Atlantis, shows us young Kida, and gives us some idea of what we're in for at the beginning. But yes, this is one of the few things you can watch on Disney Plus that is an extra.
Mistakes or big changes had to have happened for full color animation to get cut. Like, that's so rare in a Disney feature for it to get to full color and still and then get cut. Like, that is a big problem. Like, something bad happened.
Yeah, somebody who worked on the film, I forget who it was, they were one of like the story people or one of the higher ups, and they had to tell the director, I might get fired for this, but I think we need to lose this opening. And they're like, no, you're right, we just wasted a ton of money on this.
Thank you.